Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're just going to grab the dust rag and do some cleaning. That's all. So this is a show about being dedicated to our work as humans to find ourselves, to find the way to function as true to our true self as we can find. And there are different ways to do it. And some of you have heard my shows about Zen Buddhism, and they offer great opportunities. So I found this book, and it's entitled Just Grab the Dust Rag. And I was like, okay, Confessions of a Deluded Zen Student. Now, there's so many ways to fail in Zen, and Brenda has found a whole bunch of them. So I've asked her to be on the show to talk about how best to fail at Zen. Brenda Eshin Shoshana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really, really lovely to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're smiling a lot for someone who's failed so miserably at Zen. So what do you have to say for yourself?
Well, it's a wonderful paradox, because in many ways, Zen practice, and Rinzai Zen practice, and also life itself, is set up for us to fail.
Oh, great.
To fall down, and then to get up again.
But that's not new to anybody. I think we've all dealt with our failures a lot.
Except the difference in Zen practice, basically, there is really no concept of failure and success.
There is struggle.
Yes.
Zen is a lot about struggle.
Well, there is a lot of struggle in Zen practice, because whatever we are, we bring to our cushion. And if we're struggling in life, and who isn't? Because we think we have to conquer things, because we think we have to succeed, so-called. Then, of course, we begin to struggle to succeed. And whatever we are, we bring to our cushion. So, yes, of course, we experience struggle, a lot of pain.
Right.
And certainly I, in particular, and a lot of
yes,
experience of failure, for sure.
And it's in your book. And what's interesting is that you were so young and naive in your early days of Zen. You showed up at the monastery every morning before they opened the doors, eagerly ready to sit on your cushion
right.
for how long? Endless amount of time.
Long time.
Each day.
And those were the most beautiful days I can remember. I feel like crying practically. It was so beautiful to jump up out of bed at 4:30 in the morning and run to the Zendo and get there even before the doors open, waiting to get on that cushion.
Well, that's an opportunity that not all of us would long for. There are many people who are just wonderful meditators and can really get up in the morning and just start meditating, or any time of day or night. And it's wonderful to be able to do that.
Well, it was a blessing, because what happened at that time in the early, and yes, extremely naive days, and I'm afraid I might still be equally naive, or maybe even more naive.
Good for you.
As I said, deluded. I mean that quite clearly. I mean, it's not like I've learned in terms of the world's view much. I still tend to be very naive.
And yet the Zen masters put you through the mill.
Yeah, well, yeah, and he still does. And let me just say, I was very blessed.
Not just he.
All of them. That's their job.
Yes, and you went off to Japan.
Yes.
To meet the hardest of them.
Yes. Well, I met him actually up at Daibusatsu. I met Yamakawa Roshi here in upstate New York at our monastery. And then I did go over there to continue. He said, come to Japan, this training session.
But he didn't okay it with your local master.
Right.
And you got into serious trouble for that.
Oh, hell. a big piece. Yeah, I did.
But then you went off to Japan naively.
Again, naively.
Because you were invited.
Well, and because I loved working with that teacher. Mm-hmm. And because when you have a direct meeting with the teacher, it's called Dukkha-san. And we had such wonderful experience with him in Dakusan, and I felt I wanted to continue practicing with him, and he was located in Japan. So
way off in Japan, not just Japan, but right. After you get to Japan, you had to get to the monastery.
Yeah, very far away, remote, and a very, you're right, one of the most difficult monasteries to practice. Once, I did not belong there,
once,
for sure.
Right. Because what happened, as soon as you got there, tell me about the wonderful spirit you found.
The spirit I found? Well, what happened? Well, when I, you know, I guess this is really the epitome, in a sense, of Zen. I got there. After hours of traveling on the plane and having to change to another plane after Tokyo, and I was waiting for the woman who was the go-between to meet me at the airport. I only knew a few phrases of Japanese, and I was exhausted, and she was supposed to be there, and she didn't show up. I was completely by myself with a sea of Japanese people. But
finally.
Finally, somebody spoke English.
No, but finally somebody showed up to bring you to the monastery.
She did. She finally came. We got in touch with her. Okay. She came and I was brought up to the monastery.
But she was in wonderful spirit, right?
Well, she was everybody is, in a sense, a wonderful spirit. She was another difficult teacher for me.
Right. Well, let's say that. You showed up and nobody was kind to you
when
you got there.
Well, you know, there's a different kind. That's a great question, because the concept of kindness, it's a different kind of kindness.
Right. It's compassionate kindness. They want you to learn the hard lessons.
To stand on your own.
They're going to be tough on you.
To let go of that ego, that depending mind. I want you to be good to me, be kind to me, take care of me, love me. We all want that.
They weren't sweet.
Well, not in that sense, but right. The kindness was much deeper and much more profound, I would say, ultimately.
And
even
they threw
going
you
through,
in a coffin.
Well, that's what happened. Well, no, but that happens to many. In the old days, that's what they did to Zen monks who came to request admission. Yeah, they did. And you know what? In a sense, that's the heart of all Zen practice. Go face your life and your death. Don't cling to anyone else. Really, they lived it. They didn't just speak those words.
Right.
You really, really, it was a life and death experience in a lot of levels at that place. And I wouldn't certainly advise it for everyone or anyone. but you know what? When I was in that dark room, having no sense of when I would get out or whatever, I was totally thrown. I had nothing to lean on, nothing to depend on.
Except to sit.
Believe me, did I sit. I had to. They say in the old days in Zen, you're not desperate enough. You're not desperate enough. Sit harder. What they meant was you don't realize life is transient. It's only a few minutes long, even if you live 100 years. This is an important matter to face yourself and your life and your death. Sit. So by putting you into such an extreme situation with nothing to depend on, you had to depend on your zazen.
And it's forced mindfulness, but it's a deeper mindfulness than just your mind racing.
That's right, because there's a terror, and there's a knowingness. There's nothing to turn to, and then no sense of time passing. And it is, in a way, like being in your coffin. And then I heard, as I wrote in the book, the chanting of the... At 5 o'clock, they would chant the Lotus Sutra, the monks...
From outside your coffin.
Over the hill. I heard that chanting. And like that chanting, it was... I don't think I would have ever heard it in that way if I hadn't been in that state of mind and in that condition.
It was a light for
you. A light, and the beauty of it and the power of it and the meaning of it. And I'm not going to say I didn't suffer a lot, but the growth and the strength and that came from that experience and from all of Zen practice for me, it's unspeakable.
Right. And when you left that monastery, they honored you.
Pardon?
They honored you when you left.
Well, I wouldn't say honored. I don't think they honor anybody.
They were very polite.
Yeah, but the monk, the head monk there, who was had been very hard on me, terrible, right. Which is part of the training. To let go of wanting so much approval. I mean, we live our lives longing for approval.
And you started that way when you showed up as a young woman.
I still, you know, have that in me, but we keep letting go of that craving for external approval. It's an addiction.
Right.
It's an addiction. And they help us. That practice helps you cut it. But at the end, he never thought I would ever survive through the sesshin. And at the end, I was putting on my shoes, as I wrote in the book, and he said, "Oh, very nice." I mean, there was
That's
a moment.
An honor.
That was such an honor. That was, for me, I felt so, not just that he would say it and that I could do it.
Right.
And but partially, you know, you really stop looking for honor or external approbation in this when you do this kind of practice deeply, because you see that you can't depend on that either. If you're basing your life on people's approving of you and honoring you, oh God, you're in trouble down the road at some point.
And you found out when you were very young, and you went to the monastery, and you sat expecting to be given the opportunity to be a member.
Oh, yes, to belong to the group.
To belong. And they resisted that. They didn't want you to feel... And then it turned out that your Roshi, the monk, said, well, I'm not a member either.
Yeah, so in Roshi. Right, I was so hurt. You know, I couldn't wait to become a member in the early days. And then the first teacher, the monk, said, well, why is it important to be a member? What difference does it make if you're a member or not? Again, that's a great teaching. We're all longing to get an identity by belonging to something. They cut that right off. And I felt, of course, hurt. You know, you go through your own reactions. We all have these reactions, but they're not healthy reactions, the longing to belong. You just come to sit, not to belong to something. But then when the older teacher, Soen Roshi, came, and I was telling him that, he said, well, I am not a member either. I'm a member of the universe.
Okay.
Is that beautiful?
That's what it's about.
Being a member of the universe.
But we all hold it differently because we're all designed differently.
Yes.
And some people don't want to belong to anything. And other people, their identity is based on what they can identify with others with.
Exactly.
And so we just have to learn who we are.
Yes.
And to learn from perspective of reading your book to see how you were pushed around and given hard lessons so that you could... They were challenging your determination.
Yes. That's right. They were. You know, there's an old teaching that says, the only one who can be my student is someone I can throw off the mountain 10 times and who crawls back 11. Yeah, it's a different mindset. It is a challenge. I mean, what do you want? Do you want praise or do you really want to come and find the truth? And I'm quite a bit older now, and I've come to really realize that the actual practice itself, whether it's with a teacher nearby or a friend nearby or a group, just getting on that cushion, the actual practice itself is the jewel. And by the way, it's not just about sitting on a cushion. It's about taking it, as I said, grab the dust rag into your life. There's so many ways that we can sit even if we're not on a cushion.
Well, being in a monastery teaches you about the behavior of the dust rag, because there are jobs to do.
Right.
Everybody
mm-hmm.
participates
right.
in making it a beautiful monastery.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so these are life lessons of what do you want? If you want it, do it. And if you don't do it, then do something else.
Absolutely. I learned so much from my brothers and sisters. We called it the Sangha. I bring them into the book a lot. Everything I learned from my wonderful Sangha members and brothers and sisters. There's just tremendous growth just by doing your simple job and interacting with others who are in the same, doing the same practice and looking at it the same way.
And yet, there are opportunities. For instance, when you sit on the cushion, you sit still.
Yes.
You don't speak.
No.
You don't look around.
No.
And whoever's sitting around you are neighbors, but there's no social life.
That's right. Absolutely right. There's no, you don't relate in a social way. It's way deeper than that. When you sit, the people you sit with and you're silent, you don't move during sitting, you know everything about them. There's not communication, there's communion. It's on a very deep level that you're connected. And the love that pours between you is profound.
And you had to learn that because there was a woman sitting next to you for years who you didn't even like.
Sarah. Oh, we couldn't stand each other, actually. You know, and we were, because the way the seating was arranged was by seniority. And we came at the same night. We were always sitting together. And we couldn't really, we just irritated the life out of each other, which is, again, a wonderful teaching. How different people irritate you or you don't want to accept them. And yet we had to sit through it. That's one of the practices, is not to run away from it or not to analyze it either, by the way. Just sit through it.
And you got to the other side of it.
We got to the other side she would, the connection, the love, but she's, unfortunately, she's passed away at this point, but the connection between us was profound. It was beautiful. I mean, it was, and then you say, well, what was it that irritated me?
Well, you know, there's so many people that we bump into in life that are lessons for us.
Yes.
And we don't realize that we have soul connections to many of them.
Exactly.
And that it's done out of love, but we're not aware of it.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And, you know, and all the little irritations and the anger and all the emotions and the response, the reactiveness that comes up. In Zen practice, you don't analyze it. Like, you just sit through it. Like it was said by the Buddha. He said, I am a doctor who's come here to pull out a poison arrow. You've all been shot with a poison arrow. I'm going to just show you how to pull it out. I'm not going to analyze the arrow. I'm not going to look at what, you know, what angle it went in on. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just pulling out this arrow.
And the realization is that it's just an arrow.
That's right. But it hurts like hell.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But at least there's a solution.
There is a solution. And when you begin to be willing to experience it and not move and not jump into socializing, but just to be with it, it leaves. It dissolves because it's ultimately nothing at all.
And so that's a very important point about our minds and how our minds get in the way with their attachments, with their distortions, actually, of reality. And in the end, often we can be grateful for the lessons we've learned in retrospect.
Oh, I'm so grateful. I'm grateful. I can't tell you how grateful I am. And I wrote the book as a way to say thank you to my teachers, to the monks, to all of the beautiful people, and also to make the point, you know, sometimes we look up to certain teachers and we put them on top of our head as if this is a great master or this is a great teacher, and then there's so much pain and disappointment when we see that they're just human. It's not, I mean, just human, but that they're also
so
human.
So many of these masters take wrong steps.
Well, they take, you know, they're human. They give a lot.
Yes, they take human steps.
We can, you know, it's not black and white, and in Zen we have to hold the whole world in the palm of our hand, as one teacher once said, to accept the whole human being. They can give, they can be brilliant, they can be beautiful, and the next moment they can be a fool, then they can be wonderful again. How is that possible? Our mind doesn't compute that. We want everything to be just the way we hope it is. So we learn how to deal with that.
But that's the transitory nature of life, and yet the sitting for hours and hours, and if you do sessions, those are days and days of just sitting. There's a way that you are in more of the opportunity to experience less of the transitory nature.
That's right. Well, you experience so much of the trans. You see everything coming and going, and that then you find the place that doesn't move.
Exactly.
Within yourself and within the world, then you find, wow,
right.
I see.
Not moving for so many hours lets all that stuff flit around.
And it leaves.
And it comes and goes. And you realize how transitory it is.
That's right. So you're not so attached to it.
Right.
It's like flies on mosquitoes on a summer night. Buzz, 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 buzz. You're not going to swat each one. You'd be doing nothing but swatting them. They come, they go. There are periods of beauty, of bliss. Then there are periods of pain again. It's continual, even for the teachers.
And in your book, you talk about that we're not in life to become enlightened beings. We're only here to have enlightened moments.
That's what beautiful Joko Beck said. She said, I love that statement. She said, there are no enlightened people. There are only enlightened moments. That's such an honest, beautiful statement. And she said, the more you practice, the more enlightened moments you'll hopefully have.
Right.
But, you know, you could have an incredibly enlightened moment and then the next one not. So, and so many people's practices have been destroyed when they find that their teachers made mistakes and been deluded like they have. But so that's just the next teaching.
Yes. And so what it's all about is this perspective of life.
Yes.
That there's an opportunity in Zendo to have the mindfulness opportunities of the sitting that bring you to the place of perspective.
Beautifully said.
And thank you. And yet, We don't need to, sit to have our enlightened moments. We have different ways, having teachers. I think teachers are very helpful because our minds can't figure it all out.
The mind can't figure anything out.
Well, true, but I read a lot of books for this show, and so I've really learned so much, and so I've had many enlightened moments.
Good.
From the books I've read and the people I've interviewed, and yet I have many unenlightened moments.
Just by realizing that an unenlightened moment is an unenlightened moment, that is enlightenment itself.
I love that.
Just seeing it for what it is. I mean, actually, one of the beautiful things Son Roshi said was, when we do Zen practice, in whatever form we do it, whether it's on the cushion, whether it's dancing, as you said, whether it's yoga, whatever form we become aware of our experience, he said, this practice gives us the ability to digest our lives and see it for what it is.
Yes.
And we can accept the nourishment, let go of the waste. It's a very simple practice.
It's simple if you're somebody who is willing to dedicate yourself to the time of sitting.
Well, I guess when you have so much pain in what we call samsara, in living in the world of just not knowing what's going on here, having one wave after another hit you. And when you want to really have some perspective and some different understanding, when I grew up, I always said, even as a little girl, God, I knew that life was beautiful, but how come it's like this? It kept coming into my mind, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. That's what I thought as a little girl. Mm-hmm. Some part of me knew that no matter what was happening, this life was beautiful. It was beautiful, and it was meant to be beautiful. And so what I experience now is even in painful moments, even in moments when I'm very disappointed and deluded, I can feel, it's still beautiful. That's what the practice has shown me, not right. To reject any moment, not even a bitter moment.
I think we come here for the enrichment of the limiting experience of life. And it reaches in deeper into our hearts than we can reach anywhere else.
Right.
I think that's why our spirits come to Earth, is to suffer. And in that suffering, we have to go deeper. And when we get to that deeper place, then we can find the light.
Yes, we find the beauty. Even in suffering can be beautiful, although we don't have to cling to that either.
Well,
a lot of people cling to it. I have to suffer. It's my identity. And it's okay.
But when people are suffering and then they attract other people to work with them, to help them in their
right.
suffering,
they grow
then
from
they grow. They experience the love of others.
That's true. If they're willing to attract people to help them and to let go of the suffering, then suffering is a rich soil to grow in. You can also see people who just can drown in it, unfortunately, sadly,
yeah.
who
and
cling
they're designed
to it.
That way. There
who
are people
cling to it.
Who are designed to reject opportunities.
Right. But we hope that the way the world is, I certainly hope from the bottom of my heart, the way the world is now, so much chaos, so much pain looking around, it's really a good time to practice in whatever way. For everyone.
Well, there isn't a lot of awakening going on
I
now.
I think so, too.
And it's being forced to.
Yeah.
Because we can't agree with the outer world anymore.
That's right.
So we have to go to a different world.
to a deeper understanding of it, a different way to respond to it.
Yeah. And so for some people, I can understand why when you go into a Zen space, it's quiet. The gong goes off and that turns the key to open up your heart more and to be in that space.
It's beautiful. But
yeah, I can understand that. I'm not a sitter.
Let me just say, but you're not a sitter. Even right now you're sitting and you're giving off such a beautiful vibration. That's sitting.
It's a chair. It's not a mat.
It doesn't matter. We have these ideas. We have to sit 7 days. We have to sit many hours. That's not, that can be very foreboding and turn people away, including you. Even when I started, 10 minutes in the morning made such a huge difference in my day.
Mm.
I did, as long as I did it every day, kept the momentum going. It doesn't have to be hours and hours. Really, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't. When I sat there, Zen itself will take you to where you're supposed to go. But it doesn't. People think, well, if I don't do it for hours and hours, I won't be a good so-called student. That's all not true. It's even a little bit makes a huge difference in a person's life. You know, I have a little people sitting space, and people come, and this little, I've been sitting with 13 and 14 year olds, which is like heaven for me. These beautiful children, just on the edge of their life, and one of them said, "So many of my friends are cutting themselves, you know, and there's suicide." And here we just sit a few minutes, and the cobwebs. She said she was so cute. The cobwebs just went away. She's like a little flower. These are wonderful teachers. These young children. Oh my God. Just a little bit. I just wanted to say for the listeners, even a little bit makes a huge difference. It does.
And the young people who are suffering sometimes need to wake up a little later in their lives.
That's true. Some do.
We don't know Absolutely. The schedule of everybody.
No, we don't. It's just so much suicide. Young people committing suicide. It's so important to give them something of value to hold on to.
Well, we live in a very limited world, and the other side is certainly more attractive, but we do have to do our work, and that's what Zen is about, is dedication to be attentive, to get the job done,
right.
Whether it's sitting or cleaning with your dust rag. It's just the way that we have to go about life mindfully and purposefully.
Beautiful.
And if we can keep it simple to that.
Right.
Because I think there's a simplicity to Zen.
Yes.
And maybe we really need to adapt our lives to that kind of simplicity. Be in the moment. What's the best thing I can do in this moment to be dedicated to a greater path?
And just see what the moment requires of you. Usually it's clean the dust rag. Put your coat where it belongs. Give a smile to somebody who's right in front of you who might seem lonely. I mean, very simple. You're absolutely right. Beautifully said. Clear your space.
Right.
Come back to simplicity.
Pare it down.
Yeah.
You know.
So you could see what's in front of you.
Understand your priorities.
Absolutely.
And so many of us aren't in that space, so life is very confusing. So that's why it's important that we're having this discussion, and I hope it helps a lot of people.
I hope so, too. I truly do.
Yeah. So the book is called Just Grab the Dust Rag, Confessions of a Deluded Zen Student. And I guess that delusion is really how our attachments work.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't know what you were or were not attached to in those early days.
In those early days, it's still now. Of course, the process goes on endlessly.
Right.
Now I'm still attached, but to some other things.
You've had your enlightened moments, but they're not all
That's what I said. Let's be honest. Let's be real here. You know, let's be real. That's why I wrote it that way, a deluded Zen student. Sure, a lot of my attachments have changed and they've left and I'm not as affected by them, but I'm human. I'm attached.
Right.
And to see it and to work with it, that's practice.
So your name is Brenda Eshin. Eshin was given to you.
Yes, that's my Zen name.
Your Zen name.
My Dharma name.
Brenda Eshin Shoshana. And you're in New York, right?
Yes, right here.
Yeah, that's great.
A few steps away.
Oh, good. And it says here, a book of Zen moments. And that's certainly a wonderful read.
Thank you.
I went through your book a couple times because I wanted to pick out the best opportunities that were in there.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, my pleasure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.